Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of the Cheeky Natives. This is one of our other Kingsmead Book Fair specials. We've got a few lined up in store for you. And one of them is a recording with a very powerful and wonderful writer and journalist who's brave enough to actually bless us with a memoir of a very, very personal and very intimate story that we're so grateful to have had.
And it's a particular memoir, right? So it's not a memoir of, you know, some people write memoirs about their lives and certain parts of their life. Mm. This is a memoir about beaten but not broken.
Yes.
So it's a particular way in which this memoir is written.
And a very particular account of a very traumatic period in someone's life. And so in keeping with
your blurb reading.
With my blurb fans. I'm going to just read a bit of this blurb from Vanessa Govender's book, Beaten But Not Broken. At the height of her journalism career at ETV, Vanessa Govender's name and face was known by more than 1 million households across the country. She rose to fame as one of South Africa's first Indian women on television news. She might have been a familiar face, but very few people knew that she was hiding a dark and terrible secret behind the thin veneer of fame. In Beaten But Not Broken, Vanessa finally breaks her silence by chronicling in graphic detail her five-year-long hell in an abusive relationship with her colleague. Her story also lays bare her heartbreaking experience as a victim of childhood bullying and being ostracized by some in her close-knit Indian community for being dark-skinned. This brutally honest memoir gives you a painful glimpse into the heart and soul of a battered woman. It unpacks why, time and time again, she could not walk away and how she finally mustered the courage to put an end to the relationship and start the often winding journey to healing. This is a story of possibility and hope. It is the story of a true survivor.
Hmm. I suppose we need to start by saying, like, trigger warning, because this is going to be quite an intense conversation about some intense things. So trigger warning for people who may not be able to listen further. So just to say, it's going to be quite a conversation that explores a lot of abuse and a lot of violence.
So welcome to the Cheeky Natives.
Thank you very much. What an honor and a privilege.
How are you doing?
I'm good. You know, as always, these interviews and, you know, conversations that I had at book fairs or those sort of events are very soul draining. Mm. As much as it's liberating, it's also debilitating at the same time. So yes, I'm good. I've got no complaints, minus a awful sinus infection, which explains the voice, though I quite like the voice the way it is. I just may keep it.
So before we start, we'd just like you to read some parts of the book, just to give people a taste. You know, normally We want to start at the beginning of the book, but we felt that it would be important to begin the conversation at the end of the book.
Yes. So this is the epilogue, and it was written on the 6th of August 2018, literally a few days before the book had gone to print, and I was asked literally a few days before the book was going to print to write this. What should have been here was a letter to my ex, and that was taken off, and thank God that it was taken off. But you can always talk about that a little later. I am tired. I haven't been sleeping well for a few weeks now. For a couple of months, a few select people have been privy to my most private thoughts, my brutal words, and the terrible things written about in this book. The prospect of strangers now pouring through the most traumatic time in my life petrifies me. Mm-hmm. Some nights, I sleep like I'm dead to the world. Others, I lie awake into the early hours of the morning, the world asleep, but with me lying on my bed, my head spinning, feeling sad and afraid, my every nerve alert, my every pore triggered. I stifle the sobs that sometimes threaten to rip open my chest. I feel like I could flood this world with my tears and my sadness. I feel like I'm drowning in it myself some days. It has all come back with a vengeance. Everything that was done to me has come back. Writing this memoir, going over each incident, over and over, finding the words to express what happened and what I felt at the time, needing to read and reread and then trudge through them again and again, has triggered every dormant demon that has been biding its time in the deepest part of me, waiting to be acknowledged, waiting to be mourned, waiting to be healed.
So for me, I think what is really important about the book is a lot of things, but I really like the fact that she's saying, thank God the letter to your ex did not end up being the epilogue of the book. Because in the book you say, it is not about him. It doesn't matter what his name is. It doesn't matter who he is. It's not about him. This is a story about you. And I wanted to ask, why did you make that decision? You know, you could have written this book, this memoir, a different way, but you wanted to write speaking about what happened to you in relation to
Exactly. What happened to me, what I went through, what I experienced, how I got out, and how I picked up the pieces of my life. It was a very deliberate decision. It was not an easy one. It involved a lot of debate, not just with the publishers, but even with like family members, not to name him, but to also leave enough clues to make it easy to identify who it was. This book is not about him. This book is about me. It's my story. I get to call the shots here. I get to decide who's in it and who's not. And no, I do not want his name on the pages of my book for all eternity. He does not deserve that privilege. He does not deserve that recognition at all. But having said that, it's easy enough for people to figure out who it is. The reasonable average reader, Google is a wonderful tool. Google's a wonderful tool. That was not the only thing that I decided not to put in there. The religious part of it was also a very determined, concerted effort not to mention the religion. But even then, it's not hard to figure out what the religion was. And here's the thing. That decision was made because I did not want to vilify an entire community, an entire religion, based on the actions of one person. Because that is ultimately what would have happened. People would be like, oh, you know, these people are always like that. This is what they were. And that would have been the thing about the book. It would have totally, totally taken away from what the book was destined for, what it was aimed at doing. And it was almost poetic license, literary license, whatever you call it, but my decision not to name him, not to name him, not to name the religion, but also to give the reader enough to determine or to figure out who. The book is not about him. The book is about me. He can write his own book if he wants to. This is my story. I get to tell it the way I want to. And I think that's an important thing for women, because why do you need his name? Why do you need his name? Does that then validate my story? Does a man's name validate my story? Does it make it more believable? No, it's what I've been through.
Your book's title is Beaten But Not Broken, and that's an interesting title to use, because we then juxtapose these two different things, Beaten But Not Broken. So why did you choose this title? And I mean, retrospectively, what has it meant for you to have written this book?
Okay, so it originally started off as Unbreakable. And the process of editing and publishing and, you know, trying to come up with a different title, because Unbreakable apparently has been taken by a few other books. So Beaten But Not Broken was suggested to me. So it's not my, it was not my first choice, but I grew to you know, have an affinity to it. I grew to understand it, and I grew to understand the significance of that title, you know, in light of what I've written. And I could not think of a more suitable title. It's worked. It's worked. It encapsulates everything in the book, the message, what happened, and the eventual, from the tragedy to the triumph. And the title encapsulates that perfectly. You asked, what did it mean to write the book? I come from a community where we don't talk about these things. We're very conservative. The Indian community is very conservative. We don't talk about sex before marriage. We don't talk about abuse. We don't talk about alcohol consumption. We don't talk about smoking. We don't talk about all those things. I was never conventional. I was never conservative. It was inevitable from the very first time that he had struck me up until the last incident, when I woke up face down the car park of the SABC, that this was a story that was going to be told. It took me more than 10 years and that's okay. But I needed to find my voice and I needed to find my courage, especially in light of the fact that there are so many women who are dying. There are so many women who are trapped. There are so many mothers and fathers who are having to bury their daughters. There are so many women who will never get to see their children grow up. You know, I have a platform, rightfully or wrongfully or whatever it is, I have it, and I'm exploiting it to the benefit of others, because I'm out, I'm fine, I'm happy, I'm safe. Of course, I'm dealing with trauma, and that will be a forever thing until I take my last breath. But what about the women whose voices we'll never hear, whose names we'll never know? I'm obligated. I'm obligated to each and every one of them. You know, if it's not to help others get involved and do the right thing, and that is step up, get involved, help these women, then probably for these women to know that it's possible. Life, happiness, sanity, safety, it's all possible. We want to believe we're in love. We want to believe that these men are everything to us. But the bitter truth is we delude ourselves. We're always deluding ourselves, whether we forgive and go back and think they're going to change, or whether we love them. It's a load of nonsense.
We're taking a short break.
Are you a Caribbean American? Are you looking for a podcast that truly speaks to your culture and identity? Look no further than Carry On Friends, the ultimate destination for all things Caribbean American, hosted by me, Carrie Ann. Dive deep into topics such as culture, heritage, and everyday life through the unique lens of the Caribbean American experience. You'll walk away feeling more connected to your roots. Follow and listen on Apple Podcasts so you'll never miss an episode of Carry On Friends, the Caribbean American experience. Your Caribbean American community awaits.
I remember reading this book and thinking, you know, oftentimes when we speak about gender-based violence, particularly violence against women and children, and more particularly intimate partner violence, we think about women who come from impoverished communities. Mm-hmm. We think about women who don't have economic agency. Mm-hmm. We think about women who are dependent. And we think that women who work, women who are beautiful, women who are successful, are not women who are subjected to this type of violence, because they are shielded because of class privilege, because of mobility. Mm-hmm. But I think what's really important about your book is to shine a light on that, to be like, you know what? We are not safe in our ivory towers, because violence happens even in these ivory towers. So I wanted to know if one of the decisions of writing the book was to be like, I am Vanessa, and yes, I work, I'm a successful journalist, but these things happen to me.
That's exactly it. That's exactly it. We have a sort of idea of what the abused woman looks like. And she's poor, she's uneducated, she's a domestic worker, she's living in Chatsworth, she's living in an informal settlement, she's living, you know, very, very poor, dismal conditions. We have an idea of what the perpetrator looks like. Probably this obese man who drinks too much, always unemployed, who's got some crappy job. But the perpetrator here was a wealthy, affluent, well-dressed, influential, famous man. The victim was me, a journalist. I had a voice, I had a platform to be heard, I had a platform to speak out. And that breaks every stereotype, every single stereotype. And the stereotypes are what's dangerous. It's what's damaging, because we think it's there. We think it's there. But no, it's happening next door. It's probably happening in your own home. It's probably happening in your own communities, in your own family. And at the moment we dispel those stigmas and those stereotypes, we kind of try to face the problem for what it is, see it for what it is, you know. And I think too often we delude ourselves into thinking, well, it's them, it's that, you know, never us, never happening to us. But I'm afraid I think you'd find it's happening to a lot of so-called emancipated women. Mm-hmm. And this is the thing. because men have got to rein you in. How dare you have a brain of your own?
Mm.
How dare you be able to take care of yourself? You know, so they've got to rein you in.
Yeah. Another theme that comes through quite strongly in the book is the theme of shame and the ways in which shame is used is used as a weapon, really. So
abuse and shame are bedfellows,
you know, and you see it come out in how you are shamed because of your relationship with this person. So you now have this relationship that your community disapproves of. You have now participated in premarital sex, and this person then weaponizes that. He's now abusing you, and he weaponizes that. And it's also particularly interesting to see the ways in which victims bear the burden of shame,
yes,
in ways that their abusers do not.
Mm.
And I want us to just perhaps delve into how that shame then also made you almost the perfect victim for this kind of perpetrator. How he was able to weaponize the shame of looking the way that you do, being the kind of person that you are in the community that you found yourself in, and his then subsequent abuse.
And I think also connected to that is the shame also extends to the relationships closest to you.
Yes.
So there's the one incident which was very jarring for me, that you encounter the one incident where you were heavily beaten and you went into your mother's bathroom to clean up, and you walk out and your mom is like, switch on the light.
Mm.
And you're like, no. Mm. Like, no, don't do it. So there's that shame even in the most intimate of relationships that you are unable to even let those people in, because what is she going to say to you? Like, how are you going to feel that you've effectively allowed this to happen to you when you weren't even in control of this?
Because the burden of responsibility now rests on you.
Yeah. You know, the thing is, we are told as women, I'm not sure if this is prevalent in the Black community, but especially in the Indian community, you preserve yourself for marriage. Your virginity is the measure of your worth, right? And without it, you're nothing. Without it, you're all sorts of terrible things. And I had chosen to sleep with this man. He was my first intimate partner. So by virtue of that fact, I was obligated to stay. Because who's going to want me after this? Who's going to love me after this? And people will know we've been together for so long. There must have been something there or whatever. So of course, I'm ashamed. I'm ashamed of what I've done.
Mm.
But we are not empowering our girls when we say to them, save yourself for marriage. We're not empowered. It's well-intentioned, right? It's very well-intentioned, but it's not empowering, because what ultimately happens is I've slept with him. So now I've got to stay with him. Doesn't matter what happens, I've got to stay with him. So it's the shame of people finding out that there's this outspoken person, young girl, she's got a relatively, you know, prestigious job. She's on national radio. She's with this guy. My goodness, you know, she should count herself very lucky. I don't want people knowing that I'm a victim, that my boyfriend hits me, my boyfriend assaults me. I don't want people knowing, because it's ugly. It's ugly, and you don't want that. You'd rather portray a facade of having it all together. Are we happy? We are really close. We tight. Nothing can break us up, and that sort of thing. No, shame is a debilitating thing, because it silences you. It silences you, and it's only when you have actually realized, and it doesn't happen too often with too many people in this situation, is that the shame is not actually yours. Okay? I'm not the one that's violating you. I'm not the one that's violating your body. Why must I be ashamed? I've got no reason to be ashamed. But society, community, culture even, programs us as women to feel this way. And then we end up becoming enablers to these guys. We do, you know. So yes, shame was a very big part of why I kept silent. Big part of why I never asked for help, never shouted or screamed or drew attention to myself. Because I'm like, God, can you imagine somebody seeing me like that? With my nose bleeding, hey, in the SABC, in the SABC, can you imagine somebody seeing that? I mean, people obviously knew. Clearly, people were already gossiping about it, because I found out now a lot of people knew things that were going on. But no, For as long as I felt people were oblivious, I let them see Vanessa that I portray, not...
But there's also a lot of complicity.
Yes.
In the violence, right? And the different types of violence. So there's complicity in people knowing that this person may have in the past done things to certain people and not being kind enough to extend their generosity to you, Vanessa, as this young up-and-coming journalist to be like, I see you, girl. I see you are with this man. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Mm-hmm. So that you are able to make your own decisions. I feel like there is a lot of complicity in the structure of people who were working with him.
Yeah.
And even the incidents of one of the incidents that happens at the radio station where you can't, after that you aren't able to read the news, right?
Yeah.
There's a lot of complicity because people are seeing what has happened. People are hearing and people are pretending. So for me, what really made me angry about like this, and I'm wondering if it's the same for you, it's just reflecting and thinking, and even now hearing the stories of people knowing, to be like, wow, you guys just like left me to keep to do this and just didn't do anything.
And as a follow-up to that, a lot of people will also then say, oh, I feel very helpless to help this particular friend or this relative of mine who is in this situation.
Yeah.
Because I also feel that it absolves them of a lot of the responsibility of the work, right?
Yeah.
And I guess as a follow-up to the Clock Anonymous question, having now written the book and having reflected on this and the idea that people knew, how do you think that people should have helped you in that situation?
So I'd like to point out a few things. When the book first came out, somebody posted, I remember following a trail of blood from the studio to the toilet from a bust nose that you'd had. And I thought, what did you do about that?
Mm-hmm.
What did you say? Did you tell anybody? Because I was incapable. And you know, it always comes back to the victim. Oh, you must get out. You must leave. You must walk away. And it's never that easy. Because until you understand the deep psychological impact that these guys have on you, you cannot actually appreciate why it's so difficult, why we keep going back, you know. And it's not an excuse, it's not a justification, because eventually I did get out, okay, but it took a lot of, I don't know, introspection or whatever it is, but, or maybe just that quiet thing of, I'm done, I can't do this anymore. But people knew. Somebody walked in, saw him holding me up by my throat against the wall of the studio. This person confronted me. This person kept asking the relevant questions. This had reached management level at the SABC at Lotus FM. This had reached management level. Do you think this man was ever called in? Do you think I was ever called in and said, Vanessa, what's going on? Did you think anybody ever asked me the questions? No. They gossiped in their little corners. They gossiped in their little corners. Oh, I think he's beating her up. I think it's abusive or whatever. I've seen her with a thing on her nose, a gash on her nose. I saw her forehead a little bit swollen. Nobody asked me the questions. This man was eventually fired. Do you know what he was fired for? For not following the playlist. He was then rehired by the SABC. People knowing who he was and what he was doing.
Mm.
He was rehired. And then he was fired again. Right? So it was a colossal failure on the part of the SABC. It was a colossal epic failure on the part of the people in a very respectable media environment. The champions of the downtrodden, the champions of women's rights, the champions of human rights, the champions of the poverty stricken. These are the people that were giving voice to the people whose voices we don't want to hear.
Mm.
But they failed one of their own. And do you think up till now anybody in the SABC has reached out to say, we failed, we were wrong, we were sorry, but this is what we're doing to ensure it never happens again? Let me tell you what the beauty of this whole thing is. This man was actually going to join the SABC again. There was talk of him being brought back to the SABC. You know, that's accountability for you.
Mm.
That's accountability for you. And when you say people were complicit, people were very complicit.
Mm.
Because by virtue of the fact that you know or suspect, and you keep quiet and you do nothing, you are complicit.
Mm.
But you can't tell me, because what happens is then they turn around and it's victim blaming. Oh, but you should know better.
Mm.
You should know better. Well, actually, I'm incapable. I'm incapable of helping myself. You know, that's why I've told you. I sat in a little room with you smoking a cigarette and I shared with you that this is what he's doing to me. I'm asking you for help. Why do you think a woman live streams herself being slapped by her lover? Why do you think she does that? Why do you think she does that? She's asking for help. And yes, she may have gone back,
But that in itself is the dynamic of this relationship.
Mm-hmm.
That is the dynamic of this. We keep going back. Mm-hmm. I kept going back. There were flowers, there were gifts, mm-hmm. there were words, there were tears, there were beautiful promises. You keep going back, you know. And I think communities, I think family, I think friends cannot sit back any longer and say, it's not my business and it's not my problem. I'm sorry, but it is your business and it is your problem. Because very many of us are incapable of speaking up for ourselves. Very many of us are incapable of just saying, I'm done, and walking out. Because some of us actually end up dying before that happens, right? So you're obliged. You're obliged, if you know, to do something. And I think it should be, I mean, it probably is a criminal offense, right? If you know and you don't report it. It needs to, you know, it needs to become entrenched in the workplace, in the communities, wherever. And more importantly, stop telling girls, stop telling women, stop telling young girls, look for the signs and walk away. I don't want to walk away. Tell your sons, tell your brothers, tell your cousins, tell your fathers to look for the signs and to walk away. Because you absolve men of their responsibility. When you start telling women, you look for the signs and you walk away.
Just stop raping, stop beating up women. Mm. Like, just stop it. Because I think that the conversation of accountability is always shifted
to the
survivor
and
to the victim.
Of course.
Yes. Never to the perpetrator. And never perpetrator to be like, when you are angry, you walk out.
Yes.
You are the one that should walk out. When you feel that you are going to do something that you don't want to do, you walk out.
Because it also then, what it does is it creates almost this expectation that victims need to be a certain way, right?
Yeah.
So it then makes it difficult for us to empathize with certain women because we've created this idea of the perfect victim. So we struggle to empathize with the woman who is educated, who has her own financial means.
She should know better, right?
She should know better because the expectation rests on you as the survivor to be the one who says, oh, this is not okay. But it ignores the psychological...
Yes, the culpability of the man.
But also the psychological elements of abuse and what abuse does to women's psyches and what abuse does to your ability to recognize those toxicities and to walk out of those. Because I think people think that the cycle of abuse is such that this man wakes up one day and just punches you. And I think your book is beautiful because it takes you through that. I think that abusers know which kind of techniques to employ for the people that they want to abuse, right?
Yes.
So he met you and he knew that there were things that you were insecure about by virtue of the community that you found yourself in. And he then played on those things. He played on your appearance. He wrecked your self-esteem. And by the time that this person hit you, he had already laid quite a fertile ground for that abuse to take place.
Exactly. Exactly. We undermine the culpability of men because we keep focusing on the victim.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not right. It's not right. And here's the thing, I think it's very important for women to realize, whether we're mothers, sisters, friends, relatives, co-workers, women need to realize that a lot of us, and a lot of people may not like me for saying this, but a lot of us are enablers.
Mm.
We're enablers to these men.
Mm.
We are complicit in this patriarchy. We feed it, we fuel it, and then we stand back and look, why is this happening? Because we have raised these men this way. We have raised these boys to grow up to be monsters.
Mm.
We have. And mothers and wives and women need to start looking at that because we're too busy focusing on our girls. Preserve yourself. Save yourself. Whoa, 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 whoa. You know? It's all about the girl. But boys will be boys when they behave badly.
Mm.
When they beat up somebody or, you know, you've gone and accosted a girl or molested a girl or touched her inappropriately. It's boys. That's what boys do.
Mm.
I'm sorry.
Mm.
Which planet do boys do that?
Mm.
And it's okay.
Mm.
It's okay. We essentially have told boys through the decades, it's okay.
We've normalized violence in this country.
And
we've normalized
behavior.
We've normalized violence. We've just been like, actually, you know what? It's okay because boys will be boys.
Yeah.
And as you say, it takes the culpability outside of the actions.
Mm.
And also, what's really been important is, you know, Bahuk says patriarchy has no gender. And this is what you're saying. We're saying, like, we are co-opted into a system.
Yeah.
And this system has basically been, like, sometimes even the gatekeepers of patriarchy are, like, these women.
Yes.
Who are like, ah, why didn't you leave?
Mm.
Why didn't you do this?
Yes.
I mean, you, Vanessa.
What must you
people,
have done to aggravate
you? You of all people.
Yes. And this is the thing. Look at the way the media reports on stuff like this. And I've been seeing it, and it's been going on for some time, right? And I never really appreciated it until recently. So-and-so has been shot dead by her boyfriend, right? Because she was cheating. He caught her cheating on him. So that, to me, and maybe it's might be far-fetched or maybe whatever, but to me, that's almost justifying his behavior. Yes. He shot and killed her because she was cheating. He beat her up and he set her alight because she went off partying with her friends and came home late in the morning. I think those sort of things need to change. I think those things need to change because I'll tell you why. When we read those sort of articles, it's almost saying, well, okay, now we understand why he did it. Yes, of course, in journalism, we were taught who, what, why, where, when. I'm sorry, the circumstances, there is no why. You've killed somebody. End of story. There is no why, you know. And the moment we start giving the whys and the reasons, we're saying, well, you know, now we know why, you know. So, well, you know, she asked for it, really, is ultimately what we're saying, right? So I think the media has a very fundamental role to play in that reporting of how we tell the stories of these women. And we cannot only focus on the women whose names we know, the faces we know, because they're famous, because they're well known or whatever. Yes, we have a platform and we're using it in the hope of trying to change things. But what about the domestic worker? Does she not deserve the same recognition and respect that I'm getting? Does she not deserve for her story to be told with the same sort of intensity as mine is being told? Why is my story more important than hers? You know, that's what we've done. We're only interested in domestic abuse. We're only interested in gender violence. When it's somebody well known, it's a face or a name that's well known. We're only interested then. We don't care about the go-go in the township. We don't care about the lady in Chatsworth. We don't care about the lady living in a plush house in Sandton. We don't care about them. Who knows them? Who cares? You know?
There's another theme that comes through in the book, and it's a theme that we've actually had a few conversations about even prior to this, and it's the theme of colorism. The theme of colorism and the ways in which it then makes you vulnerable to this person who comes in and almost just devastates your self-esteem. So I just want us to talk a little bit about colorism and what it then meant to you growing up, what it meant for how you looked at yourself, for how you presented yourself, and how it then made you vulnerable to this abuser.
So colorism is quite rife within the Indian community. Basically works summarized or simplified. If you're dark-skinned, you're ugly, you're worthless, you're trash, nobody wants you, you're not attractive. And I grew up with that. I grew up with that where I was continuously taunted and teased by kids at school pretty much every day. Blackie, black dog, you ugly black thing. Those are the sort of things I had drilled into my head. So whenever I looked at myself in the mirror, that is what I saw, this dark-skinned, ugly person. I hated my parents for bringing me into the world. You know, I hated myself so much so that I tried to commit suicide at 10 years old. Never worked out because I'm still here. And that's what happened throughout like high school even. You know, as a teenager, it's so crushing. It's so crushing if you tell me I'm nothing because of the color of my skin, you know. And I then got into this relationship with this guy, and he was everything I wasn't. He was wealthy, he was famous, and he was very light-skinned. Like, and he was a good-looking guy. So obviously I thought, well, he's chosen me. He's chosen to be with me. I must stick this out, you know. So, and I even say it in my book, I was primed for this role as an abuse victim. I was primed for this. Colorism is ugly. It is rife. We don't want to talk about it. We don't want to admit it because, God forbid, anybody should know that we discriminate against our own.
And I think connected with colorism in the Indian community is this anti-blackness. You speak a lot about the anti-blackness that propped out. Because even in the way that people are colorist, they're anti-black, they're saying blackie.
Yes.
So it's a bad thing to be black. You know, it's a bad thing to be dark. But also there are moments in which he speaks about black people in derogatory terms.
Yes.
Because, you know, black people are... And so I wanted to also talk about the anti-blackness connected with colorism, like how that functions to other black people.
It's there. It exists. I cannot speak on behalf of everybody, but I can speak to what I've experienced. If I, as an Indian person, am discriminated against because of my dark skin, what do you think the inference is for you? What do you think the inference is for you? Okay? We can't like our own. We can't appreciate or accept our own because of their dark skin. So the rest of the people must just take a number and join the queue. Really, that's what it boils down to. Because it's there. And I don't know, you know, I think maybe it's a relic of the caste system in India. You know, we were called, dark-skinned people were Dalits. You were untouchable. You can't touch a dark-skinned person. You can't eat on the same plate. You can't drink out of the same cup. Sound familiar? You know? So, yeah, we did that to ourselves. We did that amongst ourselves. So it's no brainer that it's going to filter out. You know what I'm saying? It's going to filter out. And it's a shameful, pathetic, destructive, dangerous thing. But they didn't expect us to talk about it. They don't expect us to talk about it. Because why we should be ashamed? I should be ashamed to tell you that people called me blackie. I'm not ashamed of that. You'd be ashamed because you called me that. You know? And I think in 2019, for all our education, for all our emancipation, I think it's still there. I think it's still prevalent. I don't know that it ever goes away. But quite frankly, I've learned to embrace my darkness. I've learned to embrace my brownness. And I think there's nothing better in this world than the color of the skin that I'm in. And by speaking out, I hope that other kids who are, and I can guarantee you they are, it's happening in schools, who are bullied, who are being taunted, who are being ridiculed because they're being dark, because they're dark skinned, I hope they can find some sort of solace, find some sort of comfort, and even confidence. Hey, you know what? You know what? I'm more than this. I'm more than this. It's what's in here, in my head. It's what's in my heart. I'm more than the color of the skin. And having said that, the color of my skin makes me more powerful.
Speaking of the family, so I have two questions that relate to that. Was that ever the conversation of the colorism that was affecting you, and of your skin color, was that ever a conversation that you had at home? Were your parents ever aware of that? Was that a discussion that was had, or was it also one of those things that was shrouded in a lot of secrecy and shame? Because I mean, they must have been aware that these were age old attitudes that existed towards skin color.
So I never told anybody at home that I was being teased, because I was embarrassed about that. You know, I dare not tell my mom, because my mom would have probably gone and clubbed these kids, right? Because a lot of them lived in the neighborhood that I did. So even then, even at that young age, you learn to protect the people who violate you, whether verbally or physically or whatever. You learn that. My mom's dark skin. She's my complexion. My father was much lighter skinned. And in our community, that was an arranged marriage, but not really arranged, because he was asked to marry my mom's older sister. And he saw my mom and he liked my mom. He fell in love with my mom. And my mom was already in love with him. So she was very excited when he said, "No, I want to marry her." And you know, she'd always say to me, and I would watch them. When my mom would dress for a wedding, so she'd put her sari on, and my father would lie on the bed and watch her getting dressed, and I would be there, and he'd watch her get dressed, and he'd tell her how beautiful she was, and that sort of thing. And she would always say to me as well that she was also teased as a child by her own siblings for being dark skinned, you know. So, and she always said, "You know, your father always tells me what a beautiful woman I am." So there was never that sort of discrimination in our home. You know, if anything, he probably went overboard in making her feel beautiful. And why not? You know, why not? So it was people on the outside who made me feel inferior. And at 10 years old, don't tell me it's, you know, it's what you allow them to make you feel. You're 10 years old, for God's sake. You know, kids have this crazy ability to crush you you know, to destroy you. They're kids, but yeah, they've got this. They've got the power to do that.
And how are you grappling with the issue of race in your own home, right? And I think we were quite interested in that in your book, because there's a passage
yeah, where an interesting line in the book, which you know, jumped at me. So you say here, okay, the context is you get out of this violent relationship, you take some time for yourself, you meet a person who later becomes your husband and the father of your children. So there is hope. You're now out of this relationship, you're now in a relationship where you're wanted, and it's an interracial relationship. And so in the book you say, in our home we don't talk about race because we've shown its irrelevance. And that for me was like, I was taken aback a little, because I'm like, we live in South Africa, right? A place that is polarized by race. And how do you navigate that space where in the home, it is true that there may be certain instances that are non-racial. So certain instances where we know we're black people, but we don't talk about our blackness inside certain safe spaces. But we live in a world that is not non-racial. So how do you navigate that space with your children when you say you don't talk about race, but they are entering a world that is polarized by
particularly
race?
Particularly because they straddle two very different racial identities.
Yes.
And they're not one or the other, but they straddle both. And those are both very, very different.
Yeah.
And they're also racialized a particular way. Because we haven't been in a space in South Africa where we can claim or take mixed race
as an
identity. So you're either going to be Indian, and because of the one drop rule in the US, anything tainted by black, Indian, anything is black. So how does that work?
Gosh, you know, I really haven't thought about that, because we don't live like that. We don't live like that. So I don't know how to even answer that, like, honestly, or like give you the kind of answer that you're looking for, because we don't live that way. We don't live that way. We have just been David and Vanessa. David and Vanessa, and these kids, you know, these cappuccino colored kids. And I was actually thinking about that the other day, because you have on forms Indian, black, colored, white. What are they? What do I tick on that box? But I'm not going to allow somebody to force me to put my kids in a box, because they're not from a box. You know, they're not from a box. And we've never lived that way, like, you're white or whatever. Yes, David and I have our little quirks, and we are able to make fun of those quirks about each other, because there are some things that are so intrinsically Indian, and there's something so intrinsically white, you know. And we see the humor in that, and we do that with each other. But there's never been a thing of, not even with the children, hey? But I don't for one second doubt that it will come. And for me, you are what you are. You know, you are what you are. You're a beautiful mixture of that and that. And it's, you know, this is the future of South Africa. You know, we've all classed each other. We've all been classing each other. We've all been putting each other into boxes. And these kids, this generation, this particular, I don't know whether you call them a race group or what, I don't know what they are, you know, but these are the ones, these are the children that are going to extricate us from that. And I hope to God we can fill this world with as many mixed kids as possible, where race becomes irrelevant. It's irrelevant to me. It's always been irrelevant to me. You know, I've just never seen it. Of course I know, you know, we know our differences, but it's never mattered. It's never meant anything. I live the way I live, and if I resonate with you, I resonate with you. And it's not for any other reason except what's in your heart, what's in your soul, and I feel it, and I see it, and I want to be in your presence.
And for me, I'm just, I find it difficult, because I want to be this idealistic person. I really
not
want
idealistic.
To.
Don't
no,
get me wrong.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So I want to be this, like, because I think that particularly South Africa, with the legacy in which we come from, right?
Yes.
I struggle sometimes because I'm like, structurally, right, we know that even if I, and sometimes I feel people when people say, and I would like to believe that that's not where you're coming from. When people say I don't see race, they want to say they don't see me, because I've known that there have been instances where white people have done that. They're like,
yeah.
No, I don't see color. And I'm like,
Of course.
That's really dangerous.
Of course I know the difference. We're all sitting, there's four of us in this room. I know the difference. But my point is, I don't give a crap.
Mm.
I don't give a crap. It doesn't matter to me. I see you for who you are. Mm. I see you for a good person that you are. I see your soul. I either like that or I don't like it. You know, it's got nothing to do with being black or white or whatever. I'm not going to hate you because you're black.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to hate you because you're white, and we've been programmed to hate all white people, you know, because they're the colonialists, they've done this, they've done whatever. I was accepted into a family from a completely different race group when I was ostracized by my own community.
Mm.
So you know, probably asking the wrong person because of my own experience.
Mm-hmm.
So that is why I say, you know, you can't tell me that, you know, it's... that I'm placing people in boxes and
yeah.
race and whatever. Yes, it's there, but it's not the definitive.
Mm.
It cannot be your definitive, because for as long as we keep boxing ourselves, then, you know, we chop ourselves at the knees.
Yeah, I think, honestly, these conversations are important.
Yes.
And I appreciate your caveat, which yes. says, I've had a different experience, so I may not be the person to speak on this. Because sometimes people want to offer up intellectualized thing to be like, actually, you know what? Because this is what you're saying. You're saying, I have no doubt that these things exist, but I have not experienced them. And I've been received in a certain way. And this is my experience. And I would like to raise my children in a certain way.
Yes.
So I really appreciate that.
Thank you.
Instead of, you know... You know, sometimes giving people what they want to hear.
Yes. No, there's no sugarcoating this thing. Look, there are real issues. People are carrying real pain. There's a lot of healing to be done as a nation and as a country. A lot. And we are very far, far away from that. But these conversations are necessary. And I'll tell you what. They're necessary for very many things. But one of the reasons why they're necessary is because we tend to stereotype an entire group of people based on the actions of one or two. You know, whether it's 5, 10, 15, 20, or whatever, it then becomes all Indian people are like this, all black people are like this, all white people are like this. No, no, no. My experiences have been completely different.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes, you get these miscreants in every race group, you know. And like I say, my experience within my own community,
mm-hmm.
you know, that alone tells you, yes, I had it bad there, I had a bad experience in my community. I found love, tolerance, acceptance. With the kind of people you actually wouldn't think I should have found it with, you know.
So, what are your hopes for this book? You've told us why you've written the book, but we want to know what you hope for this book, what you hope this book will do, what you hope the conversations around this book will be.
Essentially, I think a lot of women have almost been waiting for permission to speak their truth, to say, this is what happened to me. And for a long time, we were not allowed that. And I think somebody had to take the first step. And this is just a minute, minute little step. And I think there is this revolution that's happening around the globe when it comes to women. The narrative is changing. The dialogue is changing. Women are taking back their power. They're taking back their power, and we're seeing it. We're seeing it in all corners of the globe with women who we never would think would do it. You know, the women that were kept subservient, the women who were told to shut up, put up, whatever, were taking back that power. And we are laying the foundation so that our daughters, their daughters after them, may have a safer space, a safer place, where we can walk down the street without looking over our shoulders and feel nervous because there's a man behind us, so that we may walk past a group of guys and know we're fine, so that I may go to a nightclub, have a drink without having to worry that someone's going to spike my drink and rape me. I don't want that. And we start here and now, and this book is but a minute little fraction in that revolution. But I think, hear me and hear me well, things are changing. Things are changing. And there is this sisterhood that's emerging. And it's happening all around the world. We're finding our voices. We're speaking out about the things that they told us not to speak about. We're claiming our sexuality. We're claiming our power. And there's just no silencing us from here.
That's quite powerful. And thank you so much, Vanessa, for pinning this book down. Thank you for telling your story.
Thank you.
I like that you said that this is my story when you write the book. You're like, this is my story. And thank you for, I cannot imagine how incredibly difficult it was to go back to those moments. So thank you for allowing us, firstly for writing the book, also for allowing us as the Cheeky Natives to sit down and have often very difficult and emotional conversations about abuse, about colorism, about family. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have an interesting way of rewarding our guests in studio.
Yeah, a rating system that is unparalleled.
So, you know, like when you go to the movies, they're like 5 popcorns. We're like, no. Like, well, what are you going to do with popcorn? Are you going to, no.
Yeah.
So, Alma and I run a very lucrative business, you know, a committee, the Land Committee at the Cheeky Natives. And the Land Committee basically allows us to deliberate. We read a book, we look at the topics, we look at the discussion, and we're like, okay, does this person deserve land? Because we're in the serious business of giving people
tell
land.
Me I get land. Tell me I get land.
Does this person deserve land? And where does this person deserve land? So we will give Alma the honors to bestow upon you land or not land.
So at the Land Commission,
Letlochenol and I have decided after much deliberation that we're going to give you land in your home province. And we're going to give you, in a very pristine area, we're going to give you land in La Lucia.
Guys, you guys, you shouldn't have.
And we hope that this will also just propel you to continue to tell difficult stories and to continue to take and draw strength from the fact that your story inspires so many other women. I think there are a lot of young and older women who find themselves in the same position as you, who are finding themselves being written into history, because what a lot of shame does is erases you. It erases your story, it erases your personhood, it erases your agency.
And in some instances, it defines you.
It defines you as well. And what it means to rewrite yourself and to write your narrative and to tell your stories in ways that empower you and speak truth to power is a wonderful thing to see and to do. So from the Cheeky Natives, we are very happy to give you a piece of land in La Lucia, and we hope that you continue to do the work. We want to encourage everybody to please get Vanessa Govender's book, Beaten But Not Broken. It's available at all of our favorite bookstores. Please don't DM authors. We say this on every episode because people just continue to let the devil use them. Please do not DM authors for PDFs. Please don't be asking for free copies. The labor
guys, I can't even tell you. I can't even tell you.
We know people do the most for the least.
Yeah.
The business of writing is a very serious one. It's a labor of intimacy. It's a labor of vulnerability. It's a labor of love. And the ways in which we honor those labors is to buy the work of our authors. It's to not ask a PDF, it's to not copy, it's not to borrow a copy. Just go buy a book, please.
Thank you.
We hope that you're encouraged to continue to write and to continue to tell your story, and that you're invigorated, because this is really difficult work.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the opportunity, and just want to say it's wonderful when women of color find their voices, because we have been silenced and suppressed for too long. And we've seen them emerging, and it's such a profoundly beautiful thing to read their words, because this is there long after they're gone. And what better legacy to leave for our children?
Thank you so much. So until next time, bye, Cheeky Natives.
Bye.